91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Stand by, it's Topical Currents at your service. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Our guest is association attorney and regular contributor Donna Berger. Today's At Your Service centers on condo and homeowners association issues. Among them, new association election parameters, and more important, ferreting out fraudulent election results. There have been many complaints, and a recent expose by the Miami Herald shows there have been forged signatures and votes by non-existent residents. Also, more on unexplained water leaks and the latest about condo fire sprinkler requirements. That's next. Topical Currents at your service. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Secretary of Defense confirms that a Navy SEAL has been killed in Iraq. During a stop in Germany, Ash Carter revealed that the service member was training Kurdish Peshmerga fighters a few miles behind the front lines in Erbil when ISIS fighters attacked. NPR's Philip Ewing reports on the growing threat to service members whose roles on the ground are intended to be advisory, not combat.
American troops are deploying much closer to combat than they have before as part of this advise and assist mission. So even though they're not supposed to be in direct combat with ISIS, they're getting closer to this front line, supporting Iraqi troops with artillery fire, advising Iraqi commanders at the battalion level about how to move their forces, how to fight against ISIS. And so they're closer than they were 6 months or a year ago to the danger of direct combat with these Islamic State forces.
NPR's Philip Ewing reporting. Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton heads into today's Indiana primary in a strong position. NPR's Tamara Keith says Bernie Sanders faces an uphill battle in narrowing the gap between him and Clinton.
In order for Bernie Sanders to have a chance of catching up with Hillary Clinton in pledged delegates, he needs to not just win Indiana, but win big. By our calculations, he needs to get about 65% of the vote in the state in order to be on pace to catch up with Clinton by the end of the primary season. That is a tall order.
NPR's Tamara Keith. The numbers favor the Republican frontrunner, Donald Trump, who maintains a sizable lead over Ted Cruz and John Kasich in delegates required to become the GOP presidential nominee. Under pressure to pull in enough conservative votes to stay alive until the Republican National Convention in July, Cruz is unleashing a new verbal attack on Trump, characterizing him during an appearance in Evansville as, quote, nuts, hateful, and a pathological liar.
The man cannot tell the truth, but he combines it with being a narcissist. A narcissist at a level I don't think this country's ever seen.
Trump, meanwhile, has been shifting his focus to attacks on Clinton, whom he says he will likely face in the general election. Georgia's governor is deciding whether to sign a bill into law allowing weapons on the campuses of the state's public universities. Johnny Coffin with member station WABE in Atlanta has more.
Under the bill, licensed gun holders over the age of 21 would be allowed to take their weapons on campus. It makes exceptions for some student housing and sporting events. Governor Deal has not said whether he'll veto the measure.
Well, we continue to hear a lot of opinions one way or the other. We've got certainly a divided opinion among people in our state. And those kind of things make those kind of decisions very difficult for me.
Deal has signed expansive gun rights measures in the past, but says he has concerns about safety in on-campus daycares and administrative buildings. The state university system, as well as many professors and students, say they're opposed to the measure. For NPR News, I'm Johnny Kaufman in Atlanta.
This is NPR News. The Republic of Tea has recalled a green tea blend, calling it a precaution over concerns about the possibility of salmonella contamination. The California-based company says a voluntary recall of its organic turmeric ginger green tea comes after a supplier said that one lot of its organic ginger ingredient might have been contaminated. However, no illnesses have been reported. Investor concerns about ongoing weakness in the world's second largest economy are weighing on U.S. markets. A reading on China's manufacturing sector has fallen, remains below 50, a reading that indicates manufacturing is contracting. The team behind Solar Impulse 2, the solar plane making its way around the world, is now looking at Kansas City to host the next landing. Andrew Bernier of member station KJZZ says the craft completed the 10th leg of its journey last night.
After a 16-hour flight from Mountain View, California, Swiss pilot Andre Borschberg landed Solar Impulse 2 at Phoenix Goodyear Airport. The near-silent aircraft came in powered by solar-charged batteries. Borschberg says Solar Impulse 2 is nearly the size of a Boeing 747, but only the weight of an SUV and is 97% energy efficient.
It's not only solar energy which is important. To fly with the sun, this airplane had to be extremely energy efficient, to really use the energy we produce, and then for the difference to use renewables. The mix of both is really what this airplane represents.
Abu Dhabi is their final destination. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Bernier in Phoenix.
And I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include LifeLock, reminding consumers that when shopping online or using public Wi-Fi, a trail of personal information is left behind, increasing risk of identity theft. More at LifeLock.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Boca Ballet Theater presents Spring Mix, a mixed repertory concert featuring excerpts from Auguste Bournonville's Napoli, Liam Scarlett's Viscera, and a world premiere by Sanjay Savarimuthu at the Countess de Hornley Theater at Spanish River, May 7th and 8th. Tickets and information at bocaballet.org. Sponsored in part by the Board of County Commissioners, the Tourist Development Council, and the Cultural Council of Palm Beach County.
Welcome back to Tuesday's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Thanks so much for tuning in to our At Your Service edition today. We have regular contributor Donna DiMaggio-Berger with us. She's a shareholder in the community association law firm of Becker and Polyakoff.
Of course, with many retirees and seasonal residents, South Florida is a leader in the condo market. So we'll have answers to questions about both condominium and homeowners associations. There are frequent changes to rules and regulations.
If you'd like to join in, and not just you association members, but we're going to ask you managers and boards of director members, boards of directors, to call in as well. Our number, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Also, emails are welcome at radio@wlrn.org.
So, welcome, Community Association Attorney Donna DiMaggio-Berger, a regular contributor on our program. It's always good to see you.
Good to be back.
Are
Hi,
you
Bonnie.
Ready
Hi.
For the phone?
I am ready.
Give the number again. It's 1-800-743-9576. So, Donna, since we can't seem to get away from this election season, I thought we'd begin with the subject of condo election fraud. Evidently, Miami-Dade County recorded the state's highest number of complaints of condo election fraud.
No, not Miami-Dade.
Yes.
Never.
And voting irregularities in 2015. Out of 1,908 complaints filed with the FDBPR, 566 were in Miami-Dade County. So I think my first question is, why are condo associations so rife with fraud? Is it because it's so easy?
I think the current system does make it easy for fraud to take hold. What we normally hear about is apathy, though. Nobody is actually turning out. Nobody's voting, so the same board stays in place year after year. This recent series on the fraud that's taking place in Miami-Dade County is different. What we have is people that are actually fudging the system to get other people elected. In one case, they had 115% turnout, voter turnout. I don't think we've seen that since Iraq or Syria. In another one, people, they forged signatures. It is something that clearly needs to be investigated. When you ask Bonnie, is it easy? I think under the current system, when you're dealing with paper ballots, you're dealing with, you know, the ability to forge a signature. I had teenagers. We've had teenagers. It's not that hard to forge a signature or to stuff a ballot box, or when an envelope comes in, to look at it and see a name, because the outer envelopes identify the unit number and the name. And if you're collecting those, it's not that difficult to have a few go missing.
They can just throw it out if they know it's somebody who's against what they're voting on.
What's the motivation for this? Are some people so wrapped up in being board members that they couldn't stand to be defeated? Or
I think we probably need a psychologist on the show to answer that question,
who
Joe.
Who wants it? The headaches.
I think the motivation probably varies from community to community and person to person. But for some, it's a power trip. So you may have people who acted this way in their professional careers, and now that they're retired and the association operations kind of becomes their career.
Or contract kickbacks?
Sometimes. It could be that, too. There could be a monetary incentive to stay on the board. More often than not, though, from what I've seen, it's more an ego-related control trip type of thing.
So how can we know, homeowners and the members, the residents, how can they know if there's fraud being committed?
Great question. Well, you need to get involved. And I always say this, the annual meeting with the election should not be the first election, should not be the first meeting you turn up to. Okay? I'm not saying that you shouldn't go, but there are many meetings throughout the year, board meetings that you should be attending as a homeowner.
Is there a certain amount of notice that has to be given, required notice that has to be given for a board meeting?
Absolutely. It's condominium and cooperative elections and annual meetings are highly regulated by the statute. You have a 60-day first notice, 30-day second notice, notice of intent to serve. So it's highly regulated by the statute. Now, some associations may be failing to comply with the statutory requirements for notice.
Right.
That is something that you can reach out to the Division of Condominium and say, hey, we didn't have the proper notice for our election and in our annual meeting. In terms of the fraud, though, let's also look at the other side of the coin. Some people are paranoid. What's the old saying? Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean people aren't out to get you. But some of them are paranoid. Some people are thinking there's fraud where none exists. Some people are not noticing fraud where fraud has taken a foothold. So you have both schools going on here. I would say in terms of election fraud, get involved. Know your board. Know your neighbors. The more people you know, the more difficult it becomes for fraud to take hold.
If you're accused or found guilty of election fraud in condo situation, though, is it handled as a civil or a criminal offense?
Well, that was the gist of the series, is that it's not currently handled as a criminal offense.
There's not much risk to be messing around with the election.
You'll be removed from the board.
Big deal.
That's it. There's no penalty.
Well, you'd have to prove damages. You know, you can be removed from the board. Somebody could sue for breach of fiduciary duty, because obviously you're a fiduciary as a director, and it really runs contrary to your fiduciary duties to be stuffing ballot boxes. I think we would all agree on that. There could be a potential breach of fiduciary duty claim, but what are the damages? So you have to prove, if you were running for the board, let's say, and you were kept off because of a fraud that took place, because the ballots were forged, and you didn't get on, what exactly are your damages for failing to get on that board?
Well, I guess it's so hard.
Emotional damages.
You might be more emotionally distressed if you actually got on the board and won the election.
But is there any watchdog organization, or should there be, that oversees condo association boards?
Well, yes, there is. It's called the Division of Florida Condominiums, but let's talk about that.
Okay.
And I'm not making light of this, because I think we need stronger consequences to this kind of fraud. You're absolutely right. If somebody knew they could go to jail for 5 years for stuffing a ballot box, they might think twice about doing it. There is the division, but the division the division exists on the annual funds that come into the condo trust fund. That condo trust fund is $4 per unit, per condo unit and cooperative unit throughout the state. So there's a couple million dollars in there every single year that comes in. Do you know what happens? That condo trust fund's been raided every year for the last 6 years.
By whom?
By the state. So they take those funds and they apply it elsewhere in the state's operating budget. There's been more than $24 million that had been earmarked for enforcement and education for condominium and cooperative owners in Florida, and the funds aren't there.
Well, what is that legal?
It is legal, actually, but our group call, the Community Association Leadership Lobby, we're actually mounting a petition to stop raiding the trust fund for that reason. Because it's very hard when you ask Bonnie, is there a watchdog organization? We have in Florida a lot of resources for condo and cooperative and homeowners association owners to a lesser extent. We have an ombudsman. We have a division. We used to have a council. So we have what needs to be in place, but it's just not well funded, and they're frankly strapped for time and resources and manpower.
So would online elections be of aid to this problem?
Well, July 1st, 2015, online voting became an option in Florida. Other states, many other states, had been using online voting. We finally kind of caught up. Our statutes kind of caught up down here in Florida. The division passed their rules, I believe it was March 21st. And online voting could be an option. And I'm asked, well, what about fraud in online voting? And to the example I mentioned earlier, think about the skills needed to toss out an envelope or forge a signature or stuff a ballot box. Now think about the skills somebody would need to do those things. And then think about the skills you'd need to hack into a computer system and interrupt an electronic ballot in transit.
Might be a little more difficult.
Do any of us have those skills sitting here? I know I don't. No. I know I couldn't hack into a computer.
No.
So it could be, to answer your question, Joe, it very much could be an answer. And it's something that associations who typically have also had quorum issues or have a large percentage of out-of-state or out-of-country owners. A lot of those people were disenfranchised in elections because they couldn't
they
get their
vote.
Well, they don't even get a lot of times the mail is,
right.
is their worst enemy.
Yeah.
So what if these online elections were supervised by a third party and conducted by a third party?
That can happen, too. You can have a moderated election. Obviously, the division is also going to have access to the online voting results after the fact if anything comes up. But, yes, you can absolutely have a moderator.
Let me ask you, why isn't local law enforcement involved? Why aren't these acts punishable by law enforcement? I mean, it's voter fraud.
So I believe, in my opinion, I believe because it's just easier to take a hands-off approach. They say this is a private residential community, and it's not just related to voter fraud. Lots of things take place.
Right, with the other things.
Lots of things take place inside gated communities and mandatory associations that you would think the police would want to get involved in. And
right.
when they realize their association in place, they're more than happy to abdicate that and say this is a civil matter.
We're speaking with Donna DiMaggio-Berger. We have lots of calls, lots of emails. Be patient. We're going to get to you. She's a shareholder in the Community Association Practice Group of Law Practice Group of Becker and Polyakov. Stay there and a break. We'll be right back.
Operator, this is Julia Tuttle in Miami. I need you to dial Mr. Flagler, Henry Flagler in West Palm Beach.
Yes, ma'am. Hold a moment, please.
Oh, hello again, Julia.
Henry, how are you? How's the weather there?
Fine, Julia, but we've been hit with another freeze and destroyed all the crops.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, it's beautiful weather down here, and the fruit is just divine. Come see for yourself.
That's History in the Making on WLRN-TV, your South Florida storyteller station.
Celebrate Mother's Day and support WLRN at the same time by making a contribution at WLRN.org.
As our thank you, you can choose from one of two beautiful arrangements from Field of Flowers.
You'll also be automatically entered to win a 4-pack of tickets to see WLRN Radio Theater's production of Little Women and brunch at the Broward Center.
You're going to send the flowers. You want to support WLRN. Do them both now at WLRN.org or call 1-866-247-9576.
Today's the day. Participate in the Great Give, led by the Community Foundation for Palm Beach and Martin Counties, and support WLRN. Visit WLRN.org by midnight to make your donation.
And we're back 19 minutes past the hour. It's WLRN's Topical Currents at your service. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and regular contributor Donna Berger. She's a Community Association shareholder with the law firm of Becker and Polyakov. Again, our number 1-800-743-9576. Also, email, that might be faster, radio@wlrn.org. First caller, it's Eileen Fort Lauderdale. Hello there.
Hello.
Eileen.
Hi, Eileen.
Yeah. Hi. We're having an annual meeting on the 14th, and the board of directors scheduled a board meeting on the 12th of May to push through their agenda, which involves obtaining a $150,000 loan. Is that would you say that fiduciary responsibility is kind of bent towards them getting their way because they're afraid they're not going to be reelected?
Oh, that's a great question, Eileen. Some boards do, if they fear that they're not likely to be returned to office, have an agenda and, want to kind of wrap things up knowing they may be out the door. But in this case, I wouldn't necessarily leap to any conclusions. I think it's important to understand what the loan is for. Is it for maintenance and repair and necessary replacement of the common elements? You know, it's easy to leap to conclusions like that, but if it's a duly noticed meeting, I would urge you and all your neighbors to go. One of the first things I think of when I think of associations taking a loan is, you know, checking the documents and make sure that they have the authority to take a loan for any purpose without membership approval. But again, don't leap to conclusions. I would urge you to show up to the meeting and listen to the reasons why they're taking this loan.
And one other quick question. If you put your name on to be on the board of directors, can you vote for yourself?
Yes, you can.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Okay. Bonnie, you have an emailer?
Our first emailer, Anna, a member of the board of directors of our townhouse community, is letting his boxer dog roam around the community unleashed. Clear violation of the leash rule posted around the property. Dog recently attacked another resident's dog that was walking on a leash. We've made complaints with the association. Nothing's changed. Is there anything else we could do?
I would call animal control. Wherever Anna lives, there's certainly a leash law on the books. Every city, every county has one.
And it's a member of the board of directors.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes I have to write covenant enforcement letters to members of the board. Board members are people, too, and they make mistakes, and they violate the rules, too, and they have to be held to account. So, Anna, in this case, I would suggest that if the rest of the board is not willing to get this fellow director's dog under control, I suggest that you go ahead and reach out to your local city or your county animal control and have them come out and address the situation.
Okay, Anna.
And we'll move along to West Palm Beach caller Stan. Hi, Stan.
Hi there. Hello.
Hi.
You hear me?
Yes.
Hi, Stan.
All right. I'm going to try to make myself short. All right. I'm a condo owner, and I bought my condo in 94. The rules stated I could rent my apartment for 6 months to one day, once a year. Life came along where I didn't need to do that, but the board passed an amendment, or tried to, in which they used some non-dedicated proxies to give them a number and to restrict any kind of rental. I voted against it along with three other people. I then said to the board, look, I'm grandfathered on this. They said, we will not even entertain a request for rental. I sent them a certified letter asking about it, and the president tore it up right in front of me, in front of the board. That I won't respond. That was back in 96 rather. In 98, 718 was changed, and it said in section 13 something or other.
It's 718.110, subsection 13, the grandfather.
I forgot. How about that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, right.
Do you have an easy answer for him?
Do we have an answer?
We're going back to 1995.
Right. So, Stan, I understand where you're coming from. And I'm assuming you live in a condo since you're citing the condo statute.
Right.
Okay. So your board went back and forth, but prior to the change in the law, there was no grandfathering. That law was changed. Moving forward, if they try to restrict or prohibit your right to rent, then any owner who votes no would not be held to that change. But prior to that change in law, you know, it was the case law for 30 years in Florida that owners have to, abide with changes in the governing documents if they're passed by the members.
All right, but, in reading the section, there's nothing in there that I can recall at this moment. I'm in my car. That indicated it was from this day forward. So,
yeah, well, that would be unconstitutional. That would be a retroactive impairment of contract if they started trying to apply that retroactively. So it would be from that point forward. So anything that was passed, even if you didn't like it prior to the law change, would apply to you. Anything from that point forward when 718.110 subsection 13 was amended, then you would have a right to say, I don't like this.
Okay, Stan, we have to run.
Thanks, Stan.
Thank you.
Can I ask you a question, Donna, about board meetings, not the annual, but is there any statute or any regulation on when they hold these? Like, I know of some boards that are doing it now on Friday mornings or whatever, not on the evening, so people can't be there specifically.
That is a great question. And actually, I think a few years back when we saw a lot of legislative proposals to try to address bad board behavior or mm-hmm. perceived bad board behavior, one of the proposals actually involved setting times that board meetings and membership meetings had to be held in order to facilitate the greatest participation.
Okay.
So to answer your question, no, there's nothing in the statute that sets forth the dates and times. Now, some governing documents in some communities might set forth a schedule, but boards are, you know, if you're a board member and you're listening to this program, please hold your meetings at a time when it's both reasonable for the board to meet and when you would be likely to turn out the greatest participation.
Because you hear that, and it was presumed by many people that they did this on this Friday morning just so people couldn't come because it was a very important meeting and there hadn't been one for months.
Well, you would hope that's not the case. I will tell you, I've been out to many, many board meetings, though. I've served on my own board, and it can be a bit of a challenge with some board meetings when you have an owner or a group of owners come and hold the meeting hostage. That's not an excuse, but it kind of cuts both ways, Bonnie. So if you have a board that's been burned time and time again with those kind of very dysfunctional board meetings, you can understand why the members don't want to come, and the board, it may not be, you know, they may be gripping the edge of their seats hoping that they're going to get through a meeting. Mm-hmm. So
before we go on any further, let me remind our listeners that Donna Berger is not giving any specific legal advice here, that is just kind of general interest. So that that small disclaimer there for Donna Berger and for us. Next caller, Felicia in Coral Springs. Hi there.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you all?
Good.
Hi, Felicia.
Hi. Thanks for taking our call. We have an immense number of issues in our tiny community, but the most recent issue that we've had was regarding elections. Regarding elections, does it matter the size of your community? Specifically, if your community is less than 10 units, can the board bypass sending out notices of a meeting, reelect themselves, and pass a special assessment without having a meeting open for the members to vote?
Okay, Felicia, do you live in a condo or a cooperative?
It's a condo.
Okay, due to the size of your community, fewer than 10 units, the statute does allow your community to opt out of that very regulated election process that I mentioned at the outset of the program, which begins with a 60-day first notice. That would be an opt-out. Your members would opt out, and you would go back to the procedure outlined in your governing documents for the election. That does not mean that your board can just stay in place and not conduct an election. What it means is you have to go back. You won't be following the statutory election procedure. You'll be following what the procedure is outlined in your documents. So I would urge you to look at that procedure in your documents and make sure that they're following that, okay?
And if they're not following it, what's the next act? If you can't, like, if it's not enforceable, since it's not like a statutory thing, I wouldn't be able to go to DBPR for that. I would have to.
Of course you would. If they're not following their documents and the elections are not being held pursuant to your documents, you can contact the division, the Compliance Bureau, and start an investigation. Or you have the option to hire an attorney to pursue it for you, too.
Thank you so very much,
okay.
Mr. Berger.
Okay. Thanks for
your take care.
Peter's condo board would not explain how they arrived at increases in budget line items ranging upwards of 100% a year over the year. They just said you can never predict emergencies. They couldn't explain how they arrived at their figures. Any recourse?
Well, if a board passes a budget calling for assessments that exceed 115% of the assessments from the prior year's operating budget, then the members have the right to substitute and to create a substitute budget. So Peter should look into that and make sure and see exactly what the percentage increase is for the assessments.
I don't know if he's talking about assessments. He's just talking about budget line items.
Well, but that adds up to your assessment.
So I see. Okay.
That's
okay.
Going to add up to your assessment. Okay. You know, obviously the association has an accountant. They're going to have to give out the financial reports at the end of the year. So there will be an explanation. Their documents may require an audit. So they should also look at the financial provisions in the documents to see if an audit is required annually or every so often. And depending on the size of the budget, and if it's a condominium or cooperative, they're required to undertake a certain level of financial reporting, compiled, reviewed, or audited statements. So that's another. So a board just throwing up their hands and saying we can't explain it.
Right.
Well, the financial reporting will explain it.
Okay.
So they need to make sure that the board is having the proper level of financial review undertaken and that those reports are given out. But Peter can get his answer in the reports.
We've had so much talk about board elections. What if a board really doesn't feel competent to set up the program where people can go on their computer and vote for the condo elections? Where can they turn?
Well, my firm, Becker & Polyakoff, we actually released online voting software. It's called BP Ballot. And I didn't know the scale and the level of questions. I've been inundated with questions just along those lines. People have been waiting for some option, but there's a lot of questions. For instance, we're not that computer savvy. There are a lot of companies that do this nationwide. The way BP Ballot's set up, you would go to a website. You don't need to download anything. You don't need to do anything other than have your members log on, have an internet access, and go to the bpballot.com website. There's FAQs. There's customer service. They walk you through it. But in answer to your other question previously, you can also have a moderator walk you through it. And it really is recommended the first time associations are going to use online voting, they need to have help. They need
and
to
I suppose
have
it's help. Easy to make provisions for the few people who don't have computer access or can't do that.
Well, the statute requires associations to allow people to vote manually if they want. In
right.
other words, an association
right.
can't force you to do it. But my prediction, we're going to see the shift. Over time, over the next 5 years, the majority of people will be voting online.
Yeah.
Okay, lots of emailers. We're going to try to get to as many as we can. Speaking with Donna DiMaggio-Berger, shareholder in the Community Association Practice Group of Becker and Polyakoff. 800-743-9576, the number, and radio at WLRN.org, the email.
WLRN Radio Theater presents Louisa May Alcott's classic Little Women, May 7th and 8th. Come see the golden age of radio drama come to life on stage. Tickets available at BrowardCenter.org and Ticketmaster.
Celebrate Mother's Day and support WLRN at the same time by making a contribution at WLRN.org.
As our thank you, you can choose from one of two beautiful arrangements from Field of Flowers.
You'll also be automatically entered to win a 4-pack of tickets to see WLRN Radio Theater's production of Little Women and Brunch at the Broward Center.
You're going to send the flowers. You want to support WLRN. Do them both now at WLRN.org or call 1-866-247-9576. And thanks.
We're funded by listeners like you and by Air Como. Does your business use compressed air or vacuum? Air Como's professionals have been servicing the compressed air and vacuum requirements of businesses in South Florida for over 15 years. More information at aircomo.com.
Welcome back. We're at your service on Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, visiting with Donna DiMaggio-Berger, a regular contributor, a shareholder in the law practice of Becker and Polyakoff. So before we get to calls and emails, Donna, we were talking during the break about a survey that people can take about how much condo fraud there is. What is that?
Well, we've been hearing so much about it, even for the last 30 minutes. I mentioned that we have a resource called Condo Mundo USA. And it's a resource for predominantly Hispanic communities, although they put stuff out that's of interest to everyone. But they're going to be undertaking a survey over the next 8 weeks just to find out how pervasive fraud really is. It doesn't need to be a Miami-Dade community, but it's going to be posted at www.condomundousa.com. So if you feel that there's a fraud going on in your community, they'd love to hear from you.
Hmm. Okay.
And you want to take an email first?
Okay, Gianno, here's a president of a homeowners association that's writing in, Johnny. Gianno, have been for 4 years because no one else steps up to the plate. Our condo docs require that all members, not a majority, approve changes to improvements and parking assignations. Our developer left us with a parking situation, which is a mess, among other things, as well as to update condo docs. But we can't fix the real problems, and reassigned parking is needed because of the extreme condo doc requirements for full member participation. Are there any recourses for changing these absurd requirements when people just don't want to participate? I feel we're painted into a corner to fail when we encounter new problems that need to be addressed.
A lot of people are just totally indifferent about this.
Well, yeah.
I told you once before, the most hate mail I ever got from my blog was when I suggested a condo draft, that you wouldn't run for the board. Your number would come up like jury service. I assume, Bonnie, this is an email that came in
yes,
from John.
Yes, John.
So, you know, normally when I hear about extraordinary amendatory requirements, it's tied to lender consent, and we have now mechanisms in the statutes to address that. But if they have an extraordinarily high amendatory threshold where it makes it difficult
right.
to do anything to address the parking, to address other deficiencies in the governing documents, that's going to be difficult. I think their board's going to need to sit with experienced counsel, talk about perhaps bifurcating the process, talk about first just reducing that amendatory threshold. And there are ways to do it. I mean, we've merged associations where you need 100% approval, so you can certainly overcome a very high amendatory threshold, but it's going to take tenacity, it's going to take strategy, and online voting might help as well to get people to participate
right.
to amend those documents.
Okay.
And we go back to the phones. Amy in Boca. Hello, Amy.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I'm in a HOA community, not a condo community, and our documents do not specify that we can fine people. So what that means is you don't take care of your property, pretty much all we can do is say, please take care of your property. And what I understand is that the 720 law was changed a few years ago to allow us to have fining capability if we create an arbitration committee. And we've done that, but I kind of just wanted to know if you had things to say about that process, things to, warn me about as we move forward with it. And one of the things that's come up is we don't really want to collect the fines. You know, we've done the maximum, so $1,000, $100 per day to $1,000. We don't want to collect the $1,000. We want people to take care of their property.
Okay, well, Amy, first of all, you're in a homeowners association, so you have a couple more tools than people living in condos or cooperatives do when it comes to fining. You will need a grievance committee. I know you called it an arbitration committee. It's the first time I've heard it called that. But you will need a standing grievance committee, and it cannot consist of anyone who's on the board or who lives with somebody on the board. It's supposed to be an impartial committee.
Right.
If you have that committee in place, well, congratulations, because that's half the
challenge.
These
are homeowners.
Right. These are people living in the community, and most people don't really want to sit in judgment of their neighbors. But since you've got that grievance committee in place, by the way, your documents could also, since you're a homeowners association, you can fine in amounts in excess of $100 for certain types of violations. And the homeowners association statute, Chapter 720 of the Florida statutes, does allow you to lien and foreclose as a homeowners association for fines that exceed $1,000. That was the law years ago. Then it
right.
was removed. Then it was put back in. I would tell you that I think you're going to have a hard time finding a judge who's going to allow you to foreclose on a home due to a fine. But that's something that you need to talk to your attorney about in terms of how you want to lay out the fines. You may also want to look at it. You know, fining is one enforcement tool, but there are other tools in your toolkit, including injunctive relief. You may have the ability to go in if somebody's not undertaking necessary maintenance and have the association undertake that maintenance themselves and then specially assess. This is all driven by what's in your documents. So it sounds like you really should be looking at your documents.
How about liens?
Well, liens, again, in a condo and cooperative, you cannot lien for fines at all. In an HOA, you can lien if the fine exceeds $1,000. But I think you have some practical challenges to actually being able to do that. It's not to say I don't like fines. You can always enforce a fine by going to small claims court but typically good luck collecting on that. But there's other tools. You can also go to court and get an injunction. If somebody's doing something wrong that needs to stop or not doing something that needs to be done to protect the community and the property, you can go to court and get an injunction and have the court order the person stop doing what they shouldn't be doing or start doing what they should be doing. And you can also seek your attorney's fees and costs if the association prevails in that action. So Amy, I would suggest that fining is one of your tools. You really need to get with your association attorney and find out what you can and can't do.
Okay.
Yes, they have not suggested injunctive relief, so thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Okay, thanks, Amy. Alan wants to know, this is for a co-op. There's a rule that says children under 15 are not permitted to stay more than 30 days. Is that an allowable rule, or is that age discrimination? It is not considered to be a 55 and older building.
Well, if it's not 55 and over community and there's a rule that says children under a certain age are not allowed to visit, I think they
more than 30 days.
I think they should call their insurance company immediately and put them on notice. That does make the association vulnerable if they've got language on there in their books and in their rules which discourages children. Families with children are a protected class under federal and state law.
So it is discrimination.
And it is, yes, it can be. It is discrimination. And some associations, by the way, have these antiquated rules on their books and they don't even know it. Okay, so they are committing what's called de facto discrimination, even though it's not intentional.
But if you're an over 55 community, you're okay restricting the minor visit for a month.
Right. If you're right. if you are a certified 55 and over senior housing community, you do want to restrict children. You want to, because that's what it's tied to. This community is designed as housing for older persons, but you need to be very certain that you meet all the criteria.
So you can't have your grandchild come and spend the entire summer with you in that situation.
Well, occupancy is typically tied to 30 days or more, 30 or more consecutive days. Mm. But again, it's going to be, and there's a cushion. I mean, we could get into a whole discussion on you know, fair housing and senior housing, but there is a 20% cushion. Typically, that's used for surviving spouses and adult children who inherit, not just people coming in and using up that cushion, you know, discretionally.
Okay, let's take another caller. Jay in Coral Springs, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. A question regarding getting copies of any kind of documents, including meeting minutes. Our board has stated the only way anything can be viewed is by sending a certified letter. Is that an effective fee to get a copy of a document as part of the association?
So, Jay, you live in a condo, cooperative, or home?
Well, we have a condo and an HOA in our community. We've got both. So, and the same people are on both boards.
So they have said that if you want to inspect the association documents, it needs to be by certified mail.
If I want a copy of the meeting minutes, it's got to be by certified mail.
Yeah, I don't know where they think that authority is deriving from. They may be confused with the language in the statute that says when you make a written inquiry, for instance, you have a question for your association.
No, they're not confused. They are exactly clear. They're quoting, I believe, to the 2013 statute. It may have been changed in 2014 to allow for electronic communication. But our board is saying that effective anytime, effective now, if you want to see a copy of meeting minutes from 3 months ago, I have to send a certified letter.
I would.
Or could they charge by page or something?
Well,
too,
they
or?
Can. There's two.
Well,
different...
they can charge by. But I could see it and take a picture of it. But even to see it, I have to send them a certified letter.
I would ask where they believe the source of authority is for that.
From themselves.
Okay. Well, then you really know, Jay. You know the answer to the question. You have a board that is really not adhering to best practices. They're really not all that interested in transparency. It sounds like they're throwing up hurdles again without knowing. And I often think we should have a psychologist answering some of these questions as to why people do what they do. But if other people feel the way you do that your board is being heavy-handed in this regard, then perhaps it's time to elect a new board.
Right, but they are not technically allowed to do that.
Again, as Joe says, I'm not offering legal advice to you because we would have to run conflict checks and establish an attorney-client relationship. I would ask them where they believe the source of authority is to require a certified mail request to view meeting minutes.
Right, and I mean, which I've done, and they say it doesn't matter. You have to send it certified.
Well,
so
if it were me, okay. Jay, I'd send it certified, and then I'd elect a new board.
Yeah, well, then you have apathy that comes into play.
Right.
You get a new board elected.
We have to run.
All right, thanks a lot.
Okay,
thank
you. Good luck.
Thanks. Thanks for calling, Jay. Speaking with Donna DiMaggio Berger of Becker and Polyakov. She's also an active member of CALL, which is an acronym for the Community Association Leadership Lobby. A short break, and we'll be back.
Palm Beach County Families, the SafeMap app is here to help keep your kids safe. It's a free, easy-to-use iPhone app that finds the closest locations for swim lessons, car seat installations, and bicycle helmet fittings. SafeMap also shows drop-off locations for unused prescription pills. You can go to the Apple App Store today and download SafeMap, all one word. SafeMap is brought to you by Children's Services Council of Palm Beach County.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and you can show the mom in your life how much she means to you by giving to WLRN.
Select an arrangement and make your contribution, and WLRN will send your mom that special gift along with your personal message from Field of Flowers.
And they'll be delivered in time for Mother's Day anywhere in the United States and Canada.
It's a great way to take care of mom and help WLRN at the same time.
You can give online at WLRN.org or by calling 866-247-9576. And thanks.
Miami New Drama follows up the success of The Golem of Havana with a special day based on the Oscar-winning film. You don't want to miss this critically acclaimed theatrical gem for only 4 performances at the Colony Theater May 5th through 8th. Tickets at miaminewdrama.org.
And we're back. It's today's topical currents at your service. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and attorney Donna Berger. She also has a Community Association law blog, which you can look at for periodic updates. Donna Berger has almost 25 years of experience in association law, and she's with the law firm of Becker and Polyakov.
And I just want to add that the website for that is communityassociationlawblog.com.
Okay. Now, what about the last session of the legislature? What's come out of that? Anything?
Oh, you know, everything went up in flames at the last moment. You know, they typically add all the community association proposals, bits and pieces, onto one bill. It's not atypical for people to argue over that.
So they can't cherry pick?
Now you can't cherry, and it all went up in flames. So sometimes it's better to torch it all and start over. There was one bill, Senate Bill 184 by Senator Bean, and that bill will have some significant changes in terms of associations reviewing rental applications. Associations typically have 30 days. That's the typical time frame I see in most documents for an association to review a rental application, to undertake whatever background checks they want to undertake to make sure that the renter moving in is not going to present any sort of threat to the health, safety, or welfare of the residents. Senate Bill 184, which did pass, says that if the application is being submitted by a service member, a member of the military, the association only has 7 days to undertake its due diligence on that application. So it would be my recommendation that all the associations out there who are screening rentals add language on the application asking if applicant is a member of the military, active member of the military, or a reservist.
Now, a board can really be in a very difficult situation by declining people to be able to rent. What are the appropriate grounds? Can credit ratings be looked into, of course, criminal records, I suppose, but also to make sure that you're not getting into a discriminatory practice.
Right. Again, it's all going to be derived from the governing documents and how specific those documents are with regard to the criteria that the association can use to screen. If there's no criteria listed, the association is in some murky waters. I never recommend that an association deny approval for a sale or a lease application without speaking to their association attorney. It's just too fraught with the potential for liability. But I do amend documents, Joe, that outline criminal background, financial wherewithal. The last thing you want to do is approve somebody and a month later you're in court suing them for a delinquency. If you know what your use restrictions are, you don't want to, if you don't allow four pets in a unit and somebody has five pets on their application, you certainly don't want to, again, admit that person, approve that person, and be in a covenant enforcement status a month later.
How about a quick update on the support dog business?
Oh, gosh. A quick update?
It's not going to be quick. It'll be the end of the show.
Okay, 1 minute.
One minute. It continues. People who want to bring in pets, regardless of the reason, emotional support animals.
For insomnia.
You know what? At the end of the day, here's my recommendation. If you want a pet, there's enough pet-friendly communities out there. Seek one out. And be happy in a place that wants you and your pet, where you don't have to fudge and lie and do whatever you want.
Put the dog
to get
on a diet.
Right. Put the dog. I mean, and by the way, the dog's not so. You may be using the dog for your depression. I feel most of these pets are probably depressed, being, you know, touted around to restaurants and shows when they'd rather be home on the couch.
Right. Tali, helping a buyer purchase in a condo association, currently no rental restrictions. If she purchases prior to an amendment changing the rental rules, is she grandfathered in and able to rent?
Yes. Okay. Under a condo,
okay.
Yes.
All right.
And back to the phones. We are getting close to the end of the program, so please be brief. Kale in Miami, is that correct? Hi, Kale.
Yes, Joe, you got it. Thank you so much. I have two questions. One is regarding compensation for board members of the homeowners association. Do they get some kind of salary, some kind of compensation for like a president or a treasurer or whoever?
Actually, Kale, if the governing documents allow compensation for the directors, they can be compensated. But you need to look at the governing documents and see if that's the case. If the governing documents are silent in a homeowners association, you cannot just take a salary by virtue of the fact that I'm the president or I'm the treasurer. A board member could perform other functions, be a bookkeeper, and be paid for those functions, not being paid to serve on the board, but being paid for an external function. Again, though, it doesn't pass the smell test in some communities.
Yeah, that would be a little weird, the board member being the accountant.
It happens.
Isn't that a conflict of interest?
It happens. You know, it can be. It can be, and as I said, it just doesn't pass the smell test.
What if it's the treasurer?
Well, that's a problem. That doesn't seem to have a check and balance. But to answer your question, the statute does say that if the governing documents permit compensation, it can be. If that's not something that your community really wants and doesn't think is beneficial, then you should look to amend the documents.
Okay. Thanks for your call.
Okay, Michael in Delray. Our HOA has a master board. Three communities are part of the association. Two condo associations and one single homes association. Although the condos have declarations, bylaws, etc., the homes have no declaration. Can the home board enforce its rules, sanction, or lien arrears due and payable to the master association with documents?
Well, Michael's question is going to require a review of the documents, okay. Bonnie. And I don't know how there's a homeowners association board without documents. So that's something that really is going to have to be dug into by looking at the documents and see how they're really set up.
Okay, Michael.
Sorry, Michael.
And we move along to Charles in Pompano. Hi. Charles.
Hi, thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call. I'll restructure the question to be quick. Is there ever a situation where there would be people exempt from paying association fees or assessments based on their health or indigence or
no.
Any other reason?
No.
You know, listen, the developer, when a developer is still in control of an association, the developer funds a maintenance guarantee. So they will fund assessments, but they basically, let me put this in simple terms, they're supposed to settle up at the end. So they don't have to pay as they go, but they can settle up at the end when they fund their maintenance guarantee. For other people, if I'm hearing you correctly, and this kind of speaks to Kale's question, you cannot waive regular maintenance assessments against a group of people. You can't say directors are performing a service, so they don't have to pay their assessments.
If it's a small organization and the board of directors unanimously says, we're going to give Harriet, because she had an operation, a 3-month exemption of her condo fees.
Then they would be in breach of their fiduciary duty. Okay, assessments are paid pursuant to the statute and the governing documents. Now, what that same board should do for Harriet, because I firmly believe, strongly believe, that boards should have a heart, communities should have a heart, because we're made up of people, they're neighbors. Then they should run, they should do some sort of a social event to raise money for Harriet. And whoever in the community wants to contribute to Harriet can. But saying we're going to waive her assessments, it's not something they can do without risking a breach of fiduciary duty.
And it would start other people. Well, what about my hardship and they're in the situation?
Correct. And if they are committing, violating their duties as fiduciary, as fiduciaries, what is the penalty?
Well, if they're sued, they may, you know, whether or not they're covered by D&O coverage, you'd have to look at the policy and whether or not the action is still covered.
Whether they're covered by what?
The directors and officers coverage. Okay. So sometimes directors do open themselves up to personal liability, depending on the actions they take.
Donna, I'm sure we've stimulated a lot of questions. How about some contact information where people can get more answers? Then we'll take another email.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh, great. In terms of BP Ballot that we talked about, www.bpballot.com. For me personally, you can reach me at dberger, B-E-R-G-E-R, at bplegal.com.
And you have the blog.
Oh, communityassociationlawblog.com. It's a mouthful.
Yes. Okay. And here's one more question. Recently, our maintenance fee went up different percentages for different floor plans. The middle-sized apartment fee went up by the highest percent. Is that legal? If no, what, where is the law?
You know, I would need to know who, are they still under developer control?
No,
are they post,
I don't think so.
Are they post-transition? How did this go up? Typically, when you're changing, you're going to need 100% approval if they're changing the percentage by which people pay the common expenses. So I'd be very surprised that they got 100% approval to change those percentages.
Hmm. Otherwise, it's in the original bylaws that you pay more, say, for an ocean view
it's,
or something like that.
You know, typically,
that.
So well,
assessments square footage?
Assessments can be levied on a pro rata basis, so you have 32 units, so everybody's paying 132, or on a square footage bedroom type of unit. This is going to be laid out in an exhibit to your declaration, and that's going to show the percentage by which people own their portion of the common elements and pay their percentage of the common expenses.
Well, it's been fun this hour. We've learned a lot.
We certainly have a little. It raises a lot more questions, actually.
It flew by, again.
Donna DiMaggio-Berger is a shareholder in the Community Association Law Practice Group of Becker and Polyakov. Formerly, she was the executive director of the Community Advocacy Network, and she's an active member of CALL, C-A-L-L. It's the Community Association Leadership Lobby. Thanks, Donna.
Thanks, guys.
See you
Thank
next time.
You. Bye.
And that wraps us up today. Our program was produced by Richard Ive. Technical direction provided by Jason Zabka. Our online producer is Paul Leary. Associate producer, Polly Land. And don't forget, we have free audio archives available at our website, that's WLRN.org, and more information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. And join us for tomorrow's program with veteran travel writer and author Thomas Swick. For many years, he was the Sun Sentinel travel writer. His latest book is an intimate collection of essays on how to make the most meaningful and memorable travel journeys. Thomas Swick's book is The Joys of Travel and Stories That Illuminate Them. And we'll all enjoy the journey. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.